First, though, here in the 5 o'clock hour, a guest who's been making music for more than 50 years now. He was the youngest performer on the main stage at Woodstock in the summer of 1969, had one of the biggest hit songs and most memorable tunes of the 1970s, is a successful songwriter whose work has been recorded by the likes of Ronnie Millsap, Black Hawk, Cyndi Lauper, and Judy Collins, and still touring the country with his one-man show, One Hit Wanderer. We're pleased to be joined this afternoon by Henry Gross. Henry, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. I feel like a 2,000-year-old man after you said all that.
Well, you've squeezed a lot into your time on the planet, and that's good stuff. And, it makes sense. You had, and you've described it as the perfect setup for a career in rock music with a dad who was a pharmacist and a mom who was a singer.
Yeah, well, actually, that's right. If you're a musician and a singer, it's a match made in heaven to produce a rock and roller.
Well, you got your love of music naturally and early, and then right out of high school, while still in high school, formed Sha-Na-Na. How did that come to be?
I was in a band that was playing in Greenwich Village and in all those folk clubs. I was at Brooklyn College, and a couple of my buddies in the band were at Columbia University, and they were in a glee club, and these guys did an oldie one night at one of their kind of things. It was kind of a glee club, social club thing called the Columbia Kingsmen, to differentiate it from the Kingsmen who had Louie Louie. And they did an oldie. They actually did Little Darlin'. And the reaction from everybody was insane. And the brother of one of the guys that was in the glee club, an upperclassman named George Leonard, saw this and saw the whole thing. And it was brilliant. He thought, you put three guys up front and go lamé suits, you grease your hair, you do a bunch of 50s rock and roll and doo-wop songs. And they booked, as this glee club, they booked a show called Grease Under the Stars, or The Glory That Was Grease. and they did it on the steps of Low Library at Columbia, and they thought, like their normal shows, normally they had a couple hundred people show up for their shows, and they thought, okay, maybe 500-600 people would come, but it was an outdoor show. And at least 5,000 people jammed the quadrangle, and it was complete bedlam. And the next morning, one of the guys, students and professors were dancing naked in the fountains. It was insane. And the next morning, one of the Kingsmen, a really preppy guy, quit in disgust, and I, of course, joined. And together we put together this love letter to the 1950s. We called Sha-Na-Na, and it was one of our first shows. We went and played in this club that right after that, we just took the review of that show down to the hippest club in New York. At the time it was called the Steve Paul Scene, and Steve Paul was the manager of Johnny Winter and Edgar Winter, and anyway, he had this really great club where everybody like Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton, Slim Harpo, Dr. John, just amazing people were hanging around in there, Alice Cooper. And we went on and tore the place up because it was the middle of psychedelia and everyone was expecting, some group called the Tomato Spaceship. But instead, we went out and just blew their minds, because a lot of the kids, a lot of my contemporaries, I was born in 1951, and a lot of my contemporaries really came into music with the Beatles. I had an older sister and a cousin who was about 6 years older, and so she would give me all her records. I was 5 years old, and I was playing all these Elvis Presley records when they came out. She was a big Elvis fan, and so I really came into the music with Elvis and doo-wop was what I was listening to. This was a natural for me, which is why all my records all along, you just played a little Springtime Mama. To me, that's like a doo-wop song, Springtime Mama, it's really just about the vocals, the harmonies and all that, and the good feeling. And that's doo-wop.
You mentioned Jimi Hendrix, and I understand you also you got to meet Jimmy and spend a little time with him.
Well, I knew him before we played at Woodstock. In fact, he came down to the Steve Paul Scene to see us, and we knew, I had met. I went to Midwood High School in Brooklyn, alma mater of Woody Allen, by the way. And there was a guy in the class that looked just like Jimi Hendrix. His name was Velvert Turner. Velvert actually did an album for some label after Jimmy died. And Ange Velvet is no longer with us. But he was a great guy, a really brilliant artist as a painter. And he, you know, unbeknownst to me, was a great singer, guitar player. But and his stuff is online, so you can't forget that name, Velvet Turner. Anyway, he and I were friends. He sat next to me in the mixed chorus in high school. And he would draw the teacher and people in the class, and they were, you know, they looked like professional paintings. You know, I mean, they looked like photographs. The guy was amazing. And so we remained friends, and I was coming out of a movie theater in Greenwich Village one night, ran into him with Jimmy. And we wound up going upstairs, which I assumed that was Hendrix's apartment, and we just hung out till 5-6 in the morning. So I knew him, you know, from that. And then, I didn't see him again till he came down to the Steve Paul scene. And then, of course, we opened. We went on right before Jimmy at 7 o'clock in the morning at Woodstock. And so I saw him again then, and that was the last time I saw him.
So there you were, 18 years old, playing at Woodstock. Was there any sense at the time of how this would be regarded all these years later, that this would be seen in many ways as the seminal event in the history of rock music?
Well, of course not. I mean, you know, we knew, I mean, you have to understand, the thing about that they say about Woodstock is if you remember it, you weren't really there. Well, I saw Jimmy when I got to the festival. We drove all night. It took forever because we were supposed to play Sunday afternoon. So we left, you know, Saturday night around midnight, and we didn't get to the to the hotel in Fernwood, New York, the Holiday Inn, until 9 o'clock in the morning. Because, you know, the roads were all closed, and we had a keep saying, no, no, we're playing. And again, the cops would say, yeah, you're playing. And, you know, right, sure. You know, so finally we got through and we arrived at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning. And I walked into the hotel lobby and the first person I saw was Jimi Hendrix. And he was holding a quart of Jack Daniels. And, you know, he offers me a drink. You know, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning, but you don't turn down arguably the greatest guitarist of the 20th century when he offers you a drink. So, we got pretty drunk, and then I winded up about an hour and a half later. They wanted to take me to the stage because they wanted us available. The stage was a good distance from a 10-minute drive, but would have taken 3 hours then, you know. So with all those people, so they wanted to have us by the stage. They actually they took me in this helicopter, which was the only time I've ever been on one since, and. The guy took us straight up, and I was completely drunk at that point. and he took us straight up, and he tilted the helicopter so we could see the people, the 500,000 people. And, you know, it was the most incredible sight I'd ever seen. And, you know, I would have been amazed if not for the fact that the pilot tilted the chopper with the open door, and a couple of people almost fell out.
Oh, jeez.
So we went, you know, he cleverly brought us right back. We didn't get very far. He didn't bother to take us to the stage because it was such a freak out and that people were really upset. So I went back and saw Jimmy again, who just laughed because he, you know, when I told him what happened, he saw me. I was freaked out. And he said, when I told him, he just laughed because he told me he had no sympathy at all because he had been a paratrooper.
Well, that's right.
In the Army.
Yeah.
You know, he was in the 2nd Airborne or something. Anyway, so he just said, have a drink, it'll calm you down. Drinking. And then, this is really true. You know, it sounds like nonsense when I say it, but you'll get the punchline. So I'm sitting there, finally another hour later when we're really gone. I mean, the two of us are just gone. And we're sitting at this table and everyone's coming over to say hello to him. And, you know, I was nobody and everyone's talking to Jimmy. And I was there for this and it was really great. And then a guy comes in and says, you know, your car is here. So, you know, I stumble out of the lobby, and there it is, like a 1958 Cadillac. And I'm thinking, well, this is cool. So they're going to drive me over there. Good, because I'm not getting in that helicopter again. So I get in the car, and we're just about to start to move. It's just the driver in the front, and I am, like, sprawled out in the back seat. And the door opens, and a guy slips in next to me. And it's, you know, he's got the round orange sunglasses and the beard. It's Jerry Garcia. and so he looks at me and he can see that I'm completely blitzed. you know, the beyond belief. So, you know, he offers me something to smoke. And as I say in my show, you know, I'm already higher than Kilimanjaro, but you don't turn down arguably the greatest druggie of the 20th century when he offers me something to smoke. So now, as I say, between Jimmy's Hooch and Jerry's Hemp, I'm hallucinating. So, I mean, and of course, what Jerry had was not any kind of, I mean, I was never a pot smoker. I mean, I never was involved in anything. Doesn't make me better or worse than anybody, but I never, my dad was a pharmacist, and so I stayed very far away from drugs. But anyway, whatever he had there was like anesthesia. and so this is the funny bit. Apparently, I spent the entire afternoon with Jerry in the, you know, backstage area. And apparently Jerry was holding court, and, you know, and I was telling my usual bad jokes. But I didn't know this. And the guy that was in my first band, a guy named Carl Fisher, who played bass in my first band when I was like 13 years old. His dad was a gym teacher in Brooklyn, and his summer job was going up to the Catskill Mountains where we played in the summers, and you know at the resort hotels. So his dad got the job to do security, and he hired his son for this cool thing. And Carl was actually doing security in the backstage area. And it was years later that I happened to get someone put us together somehow on the phone. And he told me that I spent the whole day with Jerry Garcia, something I certainly would have bragged of had I known it. So that's the way you can tell it's the truth, because I never told it.
You were there, absolutely. We're talking to Henry Gross on Downtown. Now, I watched earlier today a grainy video, but man, an incredible guitar solo that you did on Wipeout.
Well, who knows? That was done at 7 o'clock in the morning. We were, you know, we slept in the on the iron grating of some U-Haul truck. I mean, for 10 minutes. But it was great because I met Alvin Lee, who later on I rekindled a friendship with, because he was close to it sounds like, you know, it sounds, name dropping is awful because it makes you sound like such an ass. But I just did a 2-year tour with Joe Brown, who was George Harrison's best friend. And he's a big star in England. And, you know, Joe and Alvin were buddies. And through Joe, when I was over there, I spent a ton of time with the wonderful Alvin Lee before he passed a couple of years ago. And, you know, Alvin became a good friend. He came to Nashville and we spent some time. But I was just very fortunate that I was able to spend so much time in my life with so many great musicians and writers from the UK and from, you know, up in the United States, and just amazing, amazingly talented people. You know, I've written songs I do write songs, and I'm just recording a couple that I wrote with Roger Cook, who wrote Long Cool Woman, mm-hmm. I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing, and You've Got Your Troubles, I've Got Mine, and I Believe in You. Anyway, a million songs, Roger's. And I also wrote with a guy who retired called Tom DiRocco, who's one of the great Nashville songwriters, and we wrote a lot of really terrific songs. We just wrote and he helped me finish a great one. And so, you know, it's just been, my life has been a dream. I mean, not, you know, like everyone else's. It's been full of aggravation and loss and tragedy, but it's also been a wonderful, professionally, I wasn't the most famous person, but I was able to make enough, you know, enough and do enough shows and, you know, somehow, some way to stay alive and make music for a lifetime.
Well, yeah, after Sha Na Na, a solo career, you got to work with Jim Croce on his I Got a Name album. Talk a little bit, if you can, about your association with Cashman and West and what that did for you.
Well, I actually met Cashman and West at 80, when I left Sha Na Na, which I left, actually, the end of the story is when I saw Jimmy playing the Star Spangled Banner, I knew immediately that I was going to quit Sha Na Na, because as much as I loved it, it really was it was a show, and it was more of a spectacle, and there was not any, you know, it was really what we were going to do was done. Didn't matter what oldie you played, and it didn't really matter who sang it. It wasn't about new material, and it wasn't about, you know, doing what it is that you do. It was just really being a cover band of the 50s, so, you know, with a little bit of dancing and whatever. So it was a fun show. But I knew when I watched Jimmy, I'm thinking he's making music only he can make. Mm. I want to make music only I can make. And so I went and tried to get a record. I spent the next year playing little dumps and writing songs, and I finally got enough together, and ABC Dunhill wanted to sign me, and they sent me to Cashman and West to see what they thought, and they said, yeah, great, we'll produce them. And then they decided to use somebody else in California. So Cashman and West were bummed because they wanted to do a record with me anyway. When that deal ended, I went back and saw them, and I signed to their production company, and it seemed like a month or two later I was on A&M Records and did an album with Simone and Meet Me on the Corner that were kind of regional, big, you know, hits, you know, top 10 hits, but not in all around the country at once, but they were hits in different cities, you know, like they do very well in different places. Mm. And then the Plug Me Into Something album came out, which was fairly huge. I mean, today it would be considered huge. It sold nearly 500,000 copies, and back then that was not noticed that much.
Right.
These days it would be, you know, almost impossible. But I went on they moved me onto their own label, which wasn't, in retrospect, probably something they would do again, or I would participate in again if I had a choice. But because they simply weren't, we had Shannon, which was a huge worldwide hit. But they were a small, they were just a little record company, and they weren't able to really do what they could have done with a record that big.
So I was telling this story earlier, Henry. So I was, I'm 18, summer of 76, and I'm working in radio, and Shannon came out. Of course, we were playing it like crazy, like everybody else loved the song. But I didn't figure it out until, of all people, Casey Kasem told the story one day.
Here we go.
And I thought, God, you're killing me, Casey.
Well, you know, he wasn't saying anything negative about the song.
Oh no,
he was just upset that you know, here was the song about losing a beloved pet. And it was a terrible segue they kept making for him. That was between him and his staff. But people always bring it up. And, you know, look, I never met him. I can't speak for, for Casey Kasem. But what's the big deal? It's just a funny thing to mention. But, you know, for me, I was 25 when Shannon was a hit. And I'm 68. And in the middle, I've recorded about 350 songs. And I've got, my own little label that I have 9 songs finished for the next project, and I just do them, and I have a small fan base that has stayed with me, but they love what I do, and so I try and write some things that are a little different. I don't tip my hat to the marketplace, which is fair enough. I mean, I write songs for people my age. I write funny songs. I write serious. I wrote a song called, one of my new songs is called "I Fooled Around and Fell Asleep." I write songs that make you laugh. I wrote one about what I consider to be the state of rock and roll radio, called "Bill Haley, Won't You Please Come Home?" And for those people listening that don't know Bill Haley, in 1955 he had a record called "Rock Around the Clock," that was actually played over the credits of the movie called The Blackboard Jungle.
Right. Well, look, I love Shannon. I still love Shannon. When it comes on, whether it's on the radio or whether it's on my mobile device, I crank it up. And I was going to ask you, do you ever regret writing a song that became such a big hit that would require you to keep singing in that falsetto for 4 decades? But man, you still can nail it. I watched some clips from your One Man Show, and you sound better than you did then.
Well, thank you. This goes back, if you're listening, to having a dad who was a pharmacist. I remember he had this little drugstore in Brooklyn, and these guys, one night they tunneled through the wall to get to the drugs. And so the point was very well taken to me, at me, to look what happened there, and you don't want to be involved in that. And then so I didn't. And so, you know, if you stay healthy, I mean, I'm vegan. That's a whole other issue. You know, I try not to disturb the planet. I don't eat anything that had a mother, you know. And I just want to leave the place the way I found it as much as possible. And, you know, I do preach it, but I understand that people don't all agree, and that's fine. But that's where I'm at, and I try and stay healthy, and I walk 4 or 5 miles a day, and I prefer to sing as long as possible.
Well, and you're also doing Carl Wilson's Dog Proud because you've done a tremendous amount of work through the years as an animal activist.
Yeah, I do. In fact, I'll be doing one on August 8th in Portsmouth, Ohio. This will be the fifth year I'm doing something for Sierra's Haven, which is a no-kill shelter there. We raise money every year for the no-kill shelter there. And, you know, so I try and do whatever I can. You know, I've rescued. I mean, I've probably spent most of the money I've made in my life on animals, you know, on rescuing them and taking care of them. At one point, we had 6 cats and 4 dogs. Yeah, there was not a lot of sleep.
By the way, I've watched the clips from One Hit Wanderer. Man, it looks like such a great show. The stories, the songs that you tell of your career and the business and your life. Is there a certain freedom in not having to worry about writing hits and just, as you said, writing songs for people your age and writing songs that you're inspired to write?
Yeah, well, that's the only way I can go down the road. You know, I didn't sit down with Shannon and, you know, who would write a song about a friend's dog named Shannon. I had an Irish setter named Shannon. Carl actually had a Samoyed named Shannon, and his was hit by a car and killed. But both dogs had this, you know. And I got home and sat with my. Who would write a song about the passing of a beloved pet and expect to have a hit, especially with a, you know, in 1976, the Beach Boys found that kind of. I wrote it for Carl, so you know I was hoping that they would do it. But then the album 15 Big Ones came out. You know, Brian came back, and of course, the Beach Boys don't cut outside songs. With the great writers like Mike Love and, you know, and Carl and Brian, they didn't, mostly Brian, but they didn't need any outside songs. So, you know, I just put it out, and Carl loved the record. You know, he was very happy about it. His mom loved the record, Audrey, and. It was great, you know. It was a good thing. And Springtime Mama sold nearly 1 million copies, and you know, it's just that the record company kind of wasn't able to really do what, you know, what A&M could have done. So I think it really was. They tried their best, and you know, you in those days, you know what was happening in radio. You had to have a bank.
Right, you know? Right.
And, you know, nobody works for free. And, you know, people, you know, took a shot on Shannon. It worked. And, you know, came Springtime Mama. I guess they expected an envelope. I mean, that's what was happening, right? I mean,
right.
Well, what it is. So, you know, it was a huge record anyway, but not nearly what it would have been. I mean, you put that record on. You know, even now, and people will generally get on the phones, you know, when you play that song. And I've been in places where people play it, and then people start calling up. And the same thing happens with my new stuff. But it's impossible. There are basically, how many stations are there in the country that will play new material by a guy my age, no matter whether they love it or not? It's immaterial.
Well, you're still making great music, and again, if you go to the website, henrygross.com, you can learn so much more about Henry's music, appearances.
What a buddy you are. What a buddy you are.
Well, it's been great, Henry. It's been wonderful talking with you. I've enjoyed your music for, well, more than 40 years now. I used to play Simone a lot back in the day. I love that song.
Oh, man, there you go. That's one of my favorite songs I've ever done, and that was a really good R&B song, and man, that was a hit. That was like number one in Chicago. It went up to the top, close to the number one in Chicago. It was a big hit in Washington, Baltimore. There were a bunch of markets where that was a really big record. And Man, I was so proud of that song. There's a great Nashville songwriter called Rick Giles. And when I met him, we sat down to write a song, and he said, "I'm really nervous." I said, "What are you nervous about?" He said, "I used to play Simone in my band." And this was a big hit writer. And I just to realize that I've been so fortunate that my dreams inspired some people. What a lucky me, which is my favorite of my songs anyway.
Henry, it's a great talk. We so much appreciate you making time for us this afternoon. Good luck. Happy trails out there on the road. And hope you'll come back and visit with us again sometime.
Anytime you want, call, just give me a shout, and I'm here. I love to talk music to people that love it.
Thank you so much, Henry.
Okay.
That's Henry Gross here on Down Since 529. A little bit behind, but that was fun. Some great stories there from Henry. Again, go to the website, henrygross.com, for more information.